You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. I say welcome to another excellent conversation hosted by our very own Brookings Institution. And I'm particularly excited about this conversation in just a moment after I have the pleasure of introducing our guest. But I'm also excited because I know many of you know me as the technology lady. Yes, I am a senior fellow here as well as the director of the Center for Technology Innovation. But in my spare time leading up to that role, I'm a sociologist. And in fact, I did my dissertation research at Northwestern on the Black political experience and leading up to events around the collective memory of African-Americans when it came to issues around white supremacy and post-Reconstruction era efforts, as well as to today. So if you sift through my Brookings expert page, you'd also find out that in my spare time, when it does show up, that it's very important for me to talk about issues related to race and racism in this country, in addition to what are we going to do about it? And so there have been several pieces I've written about the Kerner Commission and perhaps reinvigorating a tool for racial equity that can put in place some policies that can address some of the structural and systemic inequalities quelling from today's exhibition of white supremacy. I'm also a person who's of color, if you've not realized that, who has a lived experience daily of what it means to live within a state where white supremacist ideology and the structures that are actually emboldened by them actually exist. And whether that is being denied entrance into a restaurant with my children, or subtly being slighted, or a person moving away from me because of whatever fear they have of Black women, it happens. And so I think it's important, particularly now, because we're in an environment where that political motivation exists to sort of summons the white supremacist in ways that we've seen before. And I really am interested in talking about this today with these esteemed guests, because this is not new. This is not a new walk around the corner. In fact, it's a re-examination of prior history that has actually shaped the foundation of where we are today. But today, the difference is that there are greater implications and consequences. And so I am joined today by four people that I admire, respect, and in many respects, in my old New York charm, love them to death when it comes to talking about real substantive issues that we can actually affect change. Joining us today is the president and CEO of the Brookings Institution, General John Allen. I am so glad that he found it on his calendar, as well as in his commitment that you all have seen exhibited in his heart to talk about this issue. I also have with me Vice President of Government Studies and the former director of CTI, my boss, Darryl West, who also speaks about this in a book prior to the last one, Turning Point, that he co-authored with John Allen on tribalization in America. And so I'm happy to hear his perspective because it gives an honest portrayal of what it's like to be white in America in many respects. Dr. Fred Harris, who is a non-resident fellow here at Brookings, happens to also be a former colleague of mine as I was finishing my dissertation many, many years ago. And he's also the author of a book, The Price of the Ticket, that came out around the time of Obama's first election. But he's a political scientist that actually delves into this issue. He's also the dean of Columbia's Social Sciences Department. And last but certainly not least, somebody who I have been stalking, somebody who I am so happy that she said yes, and someone who we have actually a mutual connection through my colleague, Rashawn Ray, Dr. Keisha Blaine, who's Associate Professor of History at the University of Pittsburgh and a 2021 fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights and Policy at Harvard University. She has too many books for me to name, but you better go and read all of them. She has a new one coming out, but she really focuses on Black nationalism as well as the African diaspora. Thank you all for joining me, and we're gonna jump right into this conversation so we have some more time for Q&A. If you are following this dialogue on Twitter, please use the hashtag #combathate, #combathate. And if you have questions, please send them to events@brookings.edu, events@brookings.edu. So Dr. Blaine, I'll start with you, okay? I wanna really do some level setting on why we're here. And I think I was sharing with you that I read over the weekend an article, and I don't wanna get it wrong because people know I can't paraphrase to death. But this article was from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And the authors wrote, "White supremacy has created the conditions we're protesting now. White nationalism seeks to exploit those conditions." And walk us through historically why this distinction is so critical now as we think about all of the recent events, particularly what the president said in summoning his white supremacist supporters that people still can't get over. But talk to us why that's an important distinction to make in terms of white supremacy and where we are now.
Well, first, Nicole, thank you so much for the invitation, and it's wonderful to be part of this conversation. You know, I certainly appreciate and I understand the context of the quote, but I would actually push back and say that I don't want to dwell so much on distinctions between white nationalism and white supremacy, because I think fundamentally white nationalism ultimately is an expression of white supremacy. Fundamentally, white nationalists embrace white supremacy. And whereas I know some people will try to emphasize or perhaps overemphasize the distinctions between the two, I think we have to recognize that the fundamental problem here is one, certainly ideology, but with ideology, praxis, that comes down to this belief in racial superiority, this belief that people of color, not non-white groups in the U.S., certainly within a global context, are simply inferior and as a result, are not supposed to have full access and certainly not supposed to experience equality in any context and in any institution. And so here's where I would say that we really need to talk about white supremacy and its roots within the U.S. context to acknowledge that, you know, the United Nations was found, you know, not the United Nations, I'm sorry, the United States was founded on the premise of white supremacy. I mean, you see that even as we think through the Constitution. And so that is the first thing to acknowledge, because we certainly want to talk about dismantling it, but it's truly difficult, not impossible, but difficult to dismantle a system that ultimately shaped the founding of the nation. And so this is why today we're still talking about this concern. We're still talking about these groups. More than 100 years ago, we'd be talking about other groups. We certainly would be talking about the KKK within the context of, Reconstruction and onward. Today, we have now so many new groups to add to the dialogue. But fundamentally, the problem is white supremacy to its core.
You know, that is so interesting, because I think as a sociologist, that's how I pretty much think of it, too, that this has actually formed society. And you aren't too far off in terms of equating white supremacy and colonization, but that's another topic for another panel, right? But I want to go to you, Daryl, because you wrote a book prior to this most recent one on these divided politics and a sense of tribalism that in many respects, and you tell the story about, you know, your own family comes from this rootedness of people's, you know, that understanding of their origins and foundation. And you also suggest in that book that, you know, that has implications for the politics of the future, if not now, in terms of how we interact with each other. Tell us a little bit more, sort of going from what Dr. Blaine said in terms of this is not something new. It's historically rooted. It's the fundamental premise for our society's upbringing. How that panned out in terms of your own experience as well as your book.
Well, thank you, Nicole. As you just mentioned, I do have a personal angle on this topic. You mentioned the book I wrote last year entitled Divided Politics, which analyzes the growth of political polarization and extremism in America. But it also is a family memoir, because I grew up in rural Ohio in an area that was very conservative. My grandfather was a member of the KKK. My two sisters are Christian fundamentalists who love Donald Trump. My brother is liberal and hates Trump, so family reunions always are very exciting. But in part, I wrote the book to understand my own background and to try and come to grips with it. So in seeking to understand white supremacy, it does not mean that I excuse it, because there clearly is no excuse for that, and we must condemn it. But condemning it does not eliminate it. So to get rid of white supremacy, I argue in that book that we have to understand why some white people feel this way and how we can reduce the number who want to oppress others. So in the book, I emphasize four different factors. One, the changing demographics of America. We know just from the demographic projections by 2044. If you add up the number of African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, it's going to constitute a majority. This is upsetting to some whites and leads to some of the very bad behaviors that we're seeing right now. They feel threatened by that shift, and they are fighting it as hard as they can. And so that's one of the reasons we see voter suppression, the violence, outright racism, and other activities designed to slow down the impact of those demographic changes. Secondly, I talk about income inequality and the loss of economic opportunity. So we're in a period of very high income inequality in this country and the decline of the American dream. And when people are suffering economically, if you look at this historically, they look for scapegoats. And it's always people who are different from themselves who get blamed for people's own poor economic opportunities. Third is the geographic disparities in the United States. Our Metro colleagues did a study a few years ago in which they found 15% of American counties generate 64% of our GDP. And so basically, most of our economic activity is taking place on the East Coast, the West Coast, and a few metropolitan areas in between. Most of America is being left behind, and those people are very upset. And then the last factor I emphasize is just the impact of technology on encouraging extremism, especially social media platforms. Because through social media and other digital tools, it is easy to find other like-minded individuals, even if the views of these people are out of the mainstream. Like in each community, there might be a relatively small number of people who have views completely outside of the mainstream. You go online, those people are a click away, and the small number of people in your local community can be hundreds, thousands, or millions of people online, and it's easy to find them. So technology eliminates the limits of geography on social mobilization, and I think this is a contributing factor. So if we're serious about addressing racism and white supremacy, we have to deal with each of these factors, and just in terms of the racism, the income inequality, the geographic disparities, and the way that technology is encouraging extremism.
And this is actually great, right? Because it's sort of now, as I wanted to do with this panel, thank you all so much so far, it was sort of following this trend, this thread, right, of how we've actually got here. Before I go to John, who I know can speak about some of the technological impacts as well as sort of this forced congregation, Fred, I want to go to you real quick, right? Because we saw, in addition to the history, in addition to the fears, essentially, that Daryl's outlining of why we see, you know, emboldened white supremacists, we also saw political leadership that had no problem whatsoever not denouncing white supremacists. That whole stand down and stand back comment, you know, really hit a nerve with many people across the country who heard just previously in Charlottesville that these were very nice people, despite a woman being plowed down and the racism that emerged over the choosing of Confederate flags. And, you know, before you got on the call, I would say to Dr. Blaine, and now we're seeing the same person sort of want to take away the 1619 Project and deem that as unpatriotic. I know this is not new. So I want you to sort of speak to our viewers first and foremost around the fact that the use by political leaders to sort of embolden white supremacist actions is not necessarily new in politics, but also maybe suggest how those stoked fears also contribute to a little bit more unrest, going back to what we've heard so far. I know you have a lot to say on this, but we can't hear you. This is what happens when I take people's breath away, as well as their voice. We did hear a bit ago. Okay.
I'm so sorry.
I know you were just caught up in the moment. I got it. It's what I do.
Very extra. Hoping to jump in this conversation. Thanks so much, as I was trying to say before, Nicole, for putting this together. As you know, I'm a political scientist whose work is very much formed by history. And so key moments for me are the periods of Reconstruction, of basically the fall of Reconstruction, of the Civil Rights Movement and what follows. And as you mentioned, my last book, the election of Barack Obama, which was also a huge moment in African-American progress. And we can talk about how substantive that was and how symbolic it was. But these sort of three moments in history really point to sort of what happens when there is progress or reform for African Americans, as there was during Reconstruction, where African American men got the right to vote, where there was a much more legal opportunities for African Americans to gain civil rights, and how it all unraveled. Unraveled through three political institutions: Congress, the Supreme Court, as well as other sort of political political institutions that came into force, like the executive branch, the presidency. And so what we're seeing is a repeat of this. I think oftentimes we see progress in the United States as a steady march, as linear and not cyclical. And I think we're caught up in another cycle. So the period we're in now is very much reminiscent of a dark period on the onset of the fall of Reconstruction and the experiences of African Americans during the height of Jim Crow during much of the 20th century, where politicians were actually inciting violence. I mean, one example I can give you many thousands, is sort of the South Carolina governor and later U.S. Senator Benjamin Tillman, who was known more famously as Pitchfork Ben Tillman, a man who really just spewed hate against African Americans and bragged on the floor of the U.S. Senate how he undermined Black voters or used the use of the shotgun to suppress voters at the polls. Many hundreds of African Americans, thousands perhaps, were killed in political violence during the fall of Reconstruction. And so I think there are two key things that we see in these various periods of reform and then retrenchment. It's the kind of rhetoric that is used during Reconstruction that gave legitimacy to Klan organizations and militias who attacked African Americans, especially those who asserted their rights. But this happened, this violence happened alongside the erosion of laws of protection, particularly of our own voting rights. So then we have sort of states using grandfather clauses, other meaning that if you could only vote if your grandfather was able to vote prior to the Civil War, which excluded African Americans, warrant, and also other sort of measures of legal voter suppression. So it's the combination of those things, the legal aspects and the violence that we're seeing now. You have to keep in mind that part of what's going on around voting rights is a consequence of what happened in 2013, which is the Supreme Court's decision around Shelby County versus Holder. And so a lot of these sort of shenanigans, a lot of these, the erosion of voting rights, the movement of voting polls, all these changes in voting laws and practices in certain states in the South would have had to go through preclearance through the Justice Department or a federal court. And so now we have the unraveling of all of this. And so again, the combination of political violence or the threat of political violence in combination and changes in voting laws has really kind of brought on the onset of white supremacist practices that I think will be detrimental in the months to come.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think when I was watching that debate and heard that statement, I was reminiscent of those times where, you know, in the civil rights movement, there were governors who could, you know, said, put the fire hoses on, bring out the dogs. We saw that. But this continued normalization of violence is what disturbs me, particularly around race. And John, I want to switch to you and I want to thank you because I know your time is busy to actually join this discussion because I think you've been talking about this in your own ways, in your own writings as well. This normalization of white supremacist violence to the point that we start with the president's remarks and just recently we end up with the Michigan governor being kidnapped almost, right? And these brutal narratives of how they were going to attack her from some of the very same groups that are now also kind of going back to what Keisha talked about, are using the premise of ideology as a way to just sort of reinforce whiteness essentially in society and pinpointing these governors, Northam being another one, was one way at that. Speak to us a little bit about, you know, when we think about what Fred said in this normalization, what how we should be thinking about these attacks going forward from these white supremacist groups who feel a lot more permission to be violent and vocal.
Sure. Fred's points and Dr. Blaine's points, Keisha's points were, I thought, very good. Look, I come at this subject from many, many years of counterterrorism activity, where I've had the opportunity to learn how terror networks are created. They're created through often a systematic radicalization of a population. This is the radicalization is both sides of the same coin. One is of white privilege, and the second is the potential encroachment upon that white privilege by the empowerment of other segments of the society, the black segment of the society. Two sides of the same coin. And that has created a centuries long, but in particular in the post-Civil War period, a almost birth moment radicalization of elements of the white American population, which in many respects systematically were intended to deny black Americans and other elements of our society from their human rights, their national rights and their human rights. So I know a lot about radicalization, and I know how elements within radicalized societies can become extremist, and how then extremists can be organized ultimately to become violent groups. And that's what we have seen here. We have seen, in essence, almost a subliminal radicalization of large segments of the white population, which makes creates a very fertile ground for recruitment into extremist organizations, from which then in these extremist organizations you begin to see violent white supremacist terror groups, for all intents and purposes. They are terror groups. So the Klan, for example, is a direct lineal descendant of the defeated members of the Confederate Army, and they are not anything other than that. Let's make sure we're all clear here. The Confederate Army was a military institution based on the premise of preserving a society that had achieved whatever wealth and independence it had based on a slave economy and the subjugation of millions of human beings. When that army was defeated by the North, elements of that army went into the Klan, and as the Klan exists today, it is a direct lineal descendant of that army. So there is a military component, a military identity with the Klan that is unignorable and undeniable. They're not the only ones, but the ideology of the Klan shoots through all of these other organizations. And then we've got the neo-Nazis, and they find themselves in an alliance together. So we have a radicalized population from which then extremists emerge, and they become violent white supremacist organizations. And what I discovered, and my background specifically dealt with the FARC in Bolivia, with the radicalized elements in the population in Bosnia, with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and then the Islamic State. All of these elements have the same commonality, which is that a radicalized population produced a violent military militia-type element. So let's take a step back and reimagine the plot that was just broken up by the FBI of the potential for the kidnapping of Governor Whitmer and ultimately Governor Northam in Virginia. How do you think we'd have reacted if it was determined that they weren't white supremacists, they were the Islamic State? We'd had active plotting by cells of the Islamic State to kidnap and ultimately torture and execute at least Governor Whitmer and potentially Governor Northam if they could have gotten their hands on him. We would be in a national frenzy right now. Yet the same uproar and the same outrage that we should feel as Americans isn't being directed at the reality that these groups intended to violently kidnap the governors of two American states and ultimately administer to them white justice. Now, here's my point. In the world I lived in for many, many years, which dealt with terrorism overseas, we had some multiple tools that were available to us, not the least of which was the foreign terrorist designation. And in a recent study which I did for the Department of Homeland Security in the context of Homeland Security Advisory Council, one of the recommendations, and the study was about ending targeted violence against faith communities, a part of which was the Black Christian community that has suffered so terribly from these groups and the burnings of their churches, etc. One of the recommendations we made is that the United States now needs to think seriously in the context of these groups creating a domestic terror designation. Because we've reached that point. They're armed, they're violent, they're networked, and many of them believe they have been given permission by the President of the United States to act this way. And as long as we're willing to see them in a manner differently than we might have perceived and reacted to the Islamic State, taking prisoner two American governors and torturing and executing them, then we've got a lot of work to do. And believe me, I get the idea that this is difficult because you got to thread the needle between freedom of speech and domestic terror. But I'm telling you, I think we can make the case that there are behaviors, there is rhetoric, and there is action that can be taken by these groups that can be very clearly articulated as the actions of terror and domestic terrorists. And we should begin to think about how we have laws that deal with that.
Because
we make that kind of activity illegal, we're going to have to deal with it in an open public sense and have disagreements of opinion about whether white supremacists should be armed with AR-15s and AK-47s in the central lobby of a state capitol, arguing with the police about whether their presence should be there or not. As long as we're having this debate, we can't get our hands around this. We've got to begin to think about dealing with white, armed white violent supremacists, ultimately as a terrorist organization.
That's right.
White supremacists, in whatever form they have taken, whether they've been wearing a Klan hood or they're neo-Nazis, they've killed far more Americans than any jihadist group could ever have hoped to. And I'm talking about the sweep of American history. What the Klan has done to the Black community of the United States, in the numbers of them who've been taken and tortured and murdered in the context of the lynching, and our unwillingness to have law ultimately ending that practice, making it a federal crime to be involved either in the plotting of or the execution of lynching, this just proves the fundamental difference that we as a people haven't come to grips with the realities of white supremacy. And until we do that, there is not going to be the true equity in our system and in our society that we must have.
That's right.
I get this from having fought terrorists around the world in several different wars. These people are no different.
That's right.
The enemy walks among us. And until we treat them as such, a large segment of our population will remain terrorized and ultimately disenfranchised because of this.
That's right. Well, John, and Darryl, I have a question for you, but I want to turn it over to Dr. Blaine and Dr. Harris if he wants to jump in. John, when I'm listening to you, what's intriguing about what you're saying in the context of this conversation of U.S. White supremacy is that, you know, you mentioned that if that had been an Israeli, jihad.
Get this right, please.
Right. Jihad style, excuse me on that, that we would have condoned the violence, right? Because it would have been seen as extremism. But if it had been a Black man or a Black woman, I don't think we would have come different from our assumptions because, you know, running counter to this is the same type of police violence of Black men and women, right? So Dr. Blaine, I'll go to you first. I mean, part of the challenge of white supremacy is sort of like this tension, right, that exists between how we even got here in the first place. I don't know if you're kind of following me because my thoughts are, this wasn't part of my question, but John actually had me thinking about this. As we're approaching white supremacy, we also are recreating structures that in many respects reinforce it in other facets of life. You know, the targeting of Black men by police, the fact that there's systemic inequalities, you know, the overcriminalization of populations of color. How do we handle these two messages like together, so that we can denounce white supremacy in its fullest form, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, as you were speaking, Nicole, and also as John was speaking earlier, I was thinking immediately about the work of Ida B. Wells, especially because even though we within today's context, we talk about police violence, police killings, and a lot of people feel very uncomfortable, you know, when I make this statement that of course, these are ultimately modern day lynchings. I mean, that's what they are. And some people quibble with that because, you know, as we often do with terminology, we try to parse out the differences and the fact that ultimately one is, you know, a public spectacle, although I would argue, how is police killings not a public spectacle, especially within the context of what we witnessed this past spring with the killing of George Floyd, for example. But I thought about Ida B. Wells within this context, because part of what she was trying to, certainly within the context of the Black community, part of what she was trying to do was declare that we certainly needed anti-lynching laws, which of course, as you know, we've been fighting for a long time and only recently managed to see some kind of progress at the federal level. And there's still more work to be done. And for her, it was about not simply waiting. Yes, she was calling for laws and policies, but not simply waiting for those laws to be passed, but trying at a grassroots level as an individual, you know, certainly backed by all these organizations like the NAACP, but even at an individual level to confront white supremacy. And I thought about, you know, her investigative work within the national context, her travels abroad, her, you know, her campaign in Britain in the 1890s to shed light on the problem. And so it's there's so much to unpack, but I think fundamentally, as we're talking about the challenges of white supremacy, for me, we can draw these clear connections to the 19th century. We can draw these connections to the 20th century, and look at how activists in these contexts confronted white supremacy, and I do think they provide a model for how we need to confront it in the modern context.
Fred, and then I'll go to Daryl on his question.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Ida B. Wells is a great example, but as Dr. Blaine knows, particularly from her work, there are various ideological strategies and traditions that evolved in moments like this that I think are very important. I think it's interesting. You always, and as a political scientist, I always get pushback on this because I'm not really a historian, but I practice being a historian in the academy, right? But so it's sometimes hard to draw parallels, and there's some pushback on that in the academy. But I mean, it's interesting to me in these periods where you have sort of the state, the American state, sort of questioning the legitimacy of African American citizenship. And from that, as we saw in the collapse of Reconstruction and in the disappointments in Black communities that came from that, you have these sentiments of this nationalist sentiments operating in very different ways from sort of Booker T. Washington's focus on economic development, some echoes or participation in immigration to West Africa, to the Caribbean. And so, of course, it's not exactly like that now, but we see these sentiments perking up in particular ways. For instance, I mean, these Black athletes who have been signed up at the big athletic programs, are making decisions now to go to historical Black colleges, right? Right. Again, sort of expressions of sort of what one could argue is national sentiments, but in another context. So African Americans have different ways of dealing with this. Activist means sort of are looking within and building institutions. In the 20th century, there were all these sort of buy Black campaigns. Those campaigns are reemerging, supporting Black businesses. Again, you see these in moments of retrenchment. And so I think part of it is the survival is what E. Franklin Frazier talked about at the turn of the century, sort of describing sort of the nation building or a nation within a nation, as he would call it, where there is a building of Black universities and colleges, Black banks, Black businesses, because of the exclusion or the attacks from the outside of society. And I think that's happening in a different way, in a different expression in the 21st century, but I think it is happening.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring that up because I think we've got, and John, you've sort of laid this out for us, right? We've got this like burning desire to find ways to really quell these injustices that have affected our world, our society. And at the same token, you know, I, as a sociologist, I got into it reading the work around the Middle Passage of women who would throw their babies in the water just to ensure that they did not grow up as slaves. And I think about in the police shootings, the type of resiliency myself as a parent have had to exercise in telling my son how to act in front of the police. I mean, this goes back to, Dare, I want to talk about this tribalization, right? Because it's almost like two Americas, right? There's this extremism that we have to deal with, John talked about. There's resiliency and resistance happening. But in the middle, we're all Americans, right? And I'm just really curious, having not grown up in Ohio on a farm with KKK relatives, like what are extremists seeking when it comes to government and to society, you know? And that could happen from the KKK uncle to, you know, the general person in rural America or parts of the society that just feel left out. What are they seeking?
I think Keisha, Fred, and John have all nailed it, just in terms of the way they have described the problem. I mean, what these extremist groups are trying to do is to perpetuate their own dominance. There's a very interesting book that came out a couple years ago by Robert Jones entitled The End of White Christian America. And what he says in that book is that for much of American history, white Christians set the tone for the country. Like, they wrote the Constitution, they set the early laws, they developed the institutional arrangements that we still have today. And so much of what happened, basically, they were the people who were in charge. That influence is now coming to an end. Loss of power is destabilizing for the dominant group, and they undertake legal, political, economic, and extra legal efforts to ensure their power. Now, I think this is a losing proposition on their part, in part due to the demographic changes that I mentioned before. I think when we move ahead 15 to 20 years from now, the whole conversation is going to be different because the country is different. The demography is going to be different. The nature of political power is going to be different. The problem we face is this transition period. Like, literally the next 10 years are going to be the difficult time. Just because, and you know, you can look at many of the contemporary fights over race, immigration, and voting rights. Like, they're all centering on these basic issues of power. Who has it? Who wants it? And how do we handle the transfer of power? I mean, that's really the essence of what I think is going on.
Yeah, we're back. We're getting a lot of questions. Lenny is starting to flood the chat box with questions. John, I want to come to you, right? We're at this tipping point. Add on to what Daryl said and then give us some guidance before we go to questions on what do we do about it? How do we start with our policies and programs?
Yeah, you have to deal with the entire sequence simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And the first part of that sequence is dealing with the armed white, violent white extremists. You got to deal with them. And there are legal remedies to that, which sadly may require violence in the other direction. But remember what I said originally, the violent white extremists aren't born, they're made. And they're made from populations that have been radicalized. And so the matter for us, you're not going to solve this problem overnight. Now, for, you know, 200 years, we've not made any effort really to solve it in the context of the totality of our population. But the continuing efforts by the media, by education initiatives, the matters associated with reconciliation, et cetera, we've got to deal with the issues that radicalize populations to believe this propaganda of the superiority of the white race, which on the other side of the same coin requires that superiority be sustained by suppressing opportunity of the black race and other races and ethnic groups. That's a long-term educational process. In the meantime, we have to deal through policy and law with the emergence of extremists and deal very explicitly with the emergence of white terrorists for all intents and purposes. As I said, as I watch this unfold, I see the recruiting processes, I see the use of social media, I see the conversations occurring in social media. In fact, I've got a conversation this afternoon about using artificial intelligence to glean trends of social conversations between these groups, how becomes an intelligence source. I see that social media has given the opportunities for these groups to both network for recruiting purposes and network between the groups, which is what they were doing in these kidnap plots, to have greater reach than we could have imagined before. So we have to be thinking about policies associated with what the social media platforms can be used for, and get both the private sector who owns the platforms and policy and legal recourse into the game to preclude those from being the organizing components for the mass movement of these organizations. Plus, we're also now seeing increasingly, and this is a concern that we have, of these groups beginning to establish communications and deep relationships with terrorists around the world, to include the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists that we see that have arisen of late in Europe. So we have transnational connections, we have domestic cross-interstate connections, and much of that is associated with social media. So we've got to deal with the connectivity that is afforded to them by social media. We have to deal with the inherent radicalization of the populations that spur the emergence of an extremist element, and then from that extremist element, the recruiting of those into white, violent, terrorist, domestic terrorist organizations. We have to deal with all of that simultaneously. It's not, I think, as one of our panelists said, it's not linear. It has to be simultaneous, and it can't be sequential. We can't deal with one and then deal with another. We've got to go after all of it simultaneously, and it can be done. It can be done. And it's just a matter of having the right kind of national leadership in position to set the example, or at least not to set the negative example that seems to empower so much of the ideology that we see abroad in the country today.
No, and I love that. And actually going back to our work at Brookings, and particularly the work that I do on AI, we have to sort of look at this algorithmic amplification, right, which actually allows for the ranking of search and the power related to these types of affinity groups that allow them to sort of usurp and co-opt the voices of others on these platforms. That's another panel, John. I think we need to do Terrell, Keisha, Fred. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, I just want to jump in. I think that it's something extremely important that both John and Daryl mentioned, particularly Daryl, about looking toward the future. How long are we going to be in this funk based on demographic change? I think a place to look, a disturbingly place to look in terms of history and looking from another perspective outside the United States, is what happened in South Africa during the transition from white rule to sort of a democracy, a multiracial democracy. And the violence that took place within that transition, it was a shorter period, but there were terrorism involved, kidnapping, threats, intimidations at the polls. So part of this is not just about demography. Demography is a part of our demographic change. It's demographic change linked to political power and other spheres of power within a society. And so I wonder if there's anything that we can learn from that experience to prevent what could be a really combustible situation in the United States in the years to come.
I mean, that to me is so brilliant in terms of the analogy. I mean, when I was in college, apartheid was a big issue, and there was a lot of people who were killed as a result of that. And I think what you're suggesting, Dr. Harris, is that there had to be a period of the civil unrest to get to a point where we had some fracturing of parts of those society in South Africa that allow for Black equity, which is so interesting. I think it is such a poignant point. I want to get to Q&A, but before I do that, yes, go ahead, John Allen.
Let me come in behind Fred on this point. I think putting what he just said in a different context, which is what he said is really important, studying strategies for reconciliation in post-conflict society is essential for us to have strategies for moving forward as a full society. And I think South Africa went through it, Timor went through it. Many countries, I just spent many months in Afghanistan, spent years in the Middle East. Almost all of those societies have had a strategy of one form or another. And some of those societies have been quite successful in navigating reconciliation without an inherent social upheaval of violence and terrorism and continued terror that could often accompany post-conflict societies trying to find an equilibrium. So it's really incumbent upon us to be studying these examples of post-conflict reconciliation to see where we can do extract best practices and apply it to ourselves as we go forward.
Yeah, it reminds me of King, right, and his work towards nonviolence and what he studied in terms of India. So, Darren, Keisha, I'm going to have you take us out before we go into questions. And there's lots of questions, everybody, lots and lots of questions. Follow us at Combat Hate on Twitter, events@brookings.edu, and I'll try to get in as many questions as possible. So, Keisha and Darrell, we had the Kerner Commission. When Lyndon B. Johnson saw this stuff breaking down, he decided we're going to go in and we'll look at the systemic roots of what's causing this. Housing inequalities, discrimination in terms of employment, you know, the burning of cities. Are we on the brink, and I'll start with you, Darrell, of a Kerner Commission reincarnated under a potential new administration?
That's interesting. I think both Fred and John mentioned South Africa. I mean, one of the elements in that transition was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where they tried to come to grips with what had happened, the abuses, the oppression, the racism that took place, and figure out a path forward. I mean, when I think about this, I kind of think out of at two different levels. There's the policy level of the changes that we will need to undertake in order to ease this transition, and that involves tax policy, education policy, healthcare policy, kind of a number of different things there. But then there's also these extra legal issues of the violence, the domestic terrorism, the hate groups. And as John has pointed out, and the report that he wrote for the Department of Homeland Security lays out a number of things we need to do to address that part of it, you know, separately from getting at the root causes, addressing the policy aspects, like, you know, having, he mentioned, you know, the foreign terrorist designation, like, do we need something like that for hate groups that would then enable more reporting so we have better information on what is taking place, a stronger law enforcement, a better training of law enforcement. So I think we need to think of it at both the policy level as well as how to handle the violent side of what is taking place.
Keisha?
So I would just quickly add, you know, I certainly do think we're at a moment where it would be useful for us to do something similar in terms of the Kerner Commission, and, you know, because it certainly is fitting considering all that we've experienced, even just within the context of 2020 and the uprisings. At the same time, I'm also thinking about the fact that the Kerner Commission fundamentally got it right, which was to show that the blame truly, you know, had to be placed squarely on the shoulders of white America, and specifically that racism, right, was the problem. Yet we've known this, right? We've known this since 1967 and didn't necessarily do anything about it. So in as much as I'm all about doing these studies and I think these reports are valuable, I think we just need to make sure that we're not doing it just for the sake of doing it in order to reinforce what we already know. I think the key is now to actually take it seriously and to figure out a strategy moving forward. So for the sake of time, that's all I'll say on that.
Well, yeah. I got a great question. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Fred.
I'll absolutely agree on that. We already know what the problems are. I mean, just looking back again, I'm very historically minded on these issues. You know, there's a huge report that came out of Chicago after the 1919 race riots. Just huge. Fast forward, you know, after the Rodney King incidents, another, I think it was called the Christopher Report, mm-hmm. came out. Not much concrete policy making and implementation came out of those. And so we keep having these commission reports. We need concrete policy. And we need, you know, places like Brookings to give us some policy ideas about what works and what doesn't work. And so, and I don't think commissions can do that for us. We need policy innovation around these issues. And so that's what I want to sort of propose as we look forward.
And I just a plug to Brookings, we are all here for it and ready to take this on because this is so fundamental to our democracy. I do have a question from Robert, and I think it's something that I think we should talk about because we have talked about the most extreme forms of racism in terms of white supremacist groups. But what about white guilt as an impediment to reconciliation? So Robert asks, is the notion of white guilt an impediment to some of these issues? Because we've talked about some of the structural pieces, But we haven't talked about, you know, the African-American men and women. Just recently, a white woman threw a dog at a puppy at a black man in the park, you know, calling the police at Starbucks. How do we address that in terms of policy? Keisha, I'll go to you. Is there a policy solution for addressing that type of white guilt?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned, the examples, the few examples, and especially I think the one concerning the park, right, where a white woman called the police on the bird watcher and made a very serious and false accusation. And within just knowing what we know about interactions with the police, it's not a stretch to say that in doing that, you know, this individual ultimately placed the black man's life at risk. He could have lost his life simply because of this phone call. And so one response is simply making sure that there are laws in place that simply discourage this kind of activity, which is to say that if you do call the police, and you make a false charge against someone and you claim that someone has threatened you or done something to you, and you use the fact that they are a person of color to bolster your case, that you will in fact face some serious consequences, quite serious, that you won't be interested in taking that kind of approach. So that's just that's one quick example of the way that we can combat these kinds of actions. And clearly this is a small example within a larger, within a larger discussion of racism and white supremacy. But that's just one quick thing that comes to mind.
That's right. Anybody else?
Nicole, if I can just add a quick footnote to what yep. Keisha said, which I think is exactly right. Technology may actually be part of the solution. I mean, technology creates a lot of problems, but on these incidents, people are taking out their cell phones and capturing it on video. The video then is played on television, and it's actually raising people's consciousness. And so I view that as an encouraging way in which crowdsourcing this problem can help become part of the solution. I mean, think of some of the killings and murders that have taken place that were caught on video. What if they had not been caught on video? Would people have been as outraged? The answer, unfortunately, is probably no. So it's like between some of the things that Keisha was talking about and the way that tech can help us, that may be a winning formula.
John, I got a question I want to throw to you from William. Recent psychological and cognitive research suggests that denouncing or criticizing bad phenomena, such as white supremacist views, reinforces rather than undermines them. What is your response on that? Are we reinforcing their behavior, or are we undermining their behavior by sort of, you know, criticizing or denouncing them?
Well, I'm at a disadvantage because I haven't read the research, so I'll take it at face value. But I'll just go back to what I said before. We have to criticize that behavior. As responsible citizens, we should take no other position. But again, the behavior is a function of a sequence of causal factors that has delivered us ultimately to a group of people who believe in their cause so much that they're willing to take up arms and act as terrorists against a segment of the American population. We will only solve that through education and through taking the steps that are necessary to reduce the radicalization of a population that believes that they must retain and preserve their privilege in a way that inherently disadvantages another segment of the society. So I always had a problem with this countering violent extremism strategy, because if our strategy begins when you counter violent extremism, you're too late. We should be dealing with what creates an extremist, not just a violent extremist, what creates an extremist, and ultimately what creates the radicalizing factors that permits extremism to take root in a segment of the society. We have to deal with all of that. I don't know how we can responsibly not criticize violent white extremists. And if there is a body of research out there that says if we do, we reinforce their cause or expand their numbers, I would have to question that. I mean, my own experience with the terrorist groups has been you got to deal with the terrorist group that is committed and intent upon doing violence upon elements of the society. So in Iraq, it was Shia on Sunni, Sunni on Shia, both on the Kurds. In Afghanistan, it was whatever tribe it was against another tribe. We had to deal with the violence because it was in our face. But we couldn't only deal with the violence. We had to go upstream, determine what the causal factors were ultimately of that violence, and begin to address those. And you address those amongst the youth. You address that in the economy. You address that in the leadership and governance. Look, I talked about reconciliation. Anywhere where a reconciliation in a post-conflict society has ever worked, it came from powerful, assertive, morally guided, values-based leadership. And where it's not succeeded, it's generally where leadership has failed. So when we find ourselves surrounded by leaders who are committed to reconciliation, some part of which is about administering justice, but some part of which is about compassionate forgiveness. I mean, that's part of truth and reconciliation. We can only go forward with the right kind of leadership and a program of reconciliation that touches all segments of the population. It can't just be focused on the gun-toting white extremists.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think for that person too, you have to call it out. If you don't call it out, you're, as someone said, silently complacent.
Of course.
With what's actually happening with society. And we've never gotten far in this country with silent complacency, right? Complacency.
It will get you killed.
Yeah, it will. It will. And that has happened to so many communities of color where we have allowed these things to happen to us over periods of time. I mean, that brings me to another question. I'll throw it to the whole group. And then I got one question I want to end with. So if you keep your comments brief here, what do white allies do to influence policy to address systemic racism and other inequalities? What can white allies do to influence, this comes from Deborah, to address systemic racism and other inequalities?
They can do what Malcolm X told them to do when he was asked by a young white woman about what is it that the white community could do for Black liberation. And he told them, you need to go back and tell your brothers, your sisters, your mother, your aunts, your uncles about anti-Black racism. And so not only can they contribute to the movement itself, but they can also be a part of consciousness raising within their own families and within their own communities. And so I think perhaps that's one of the most important contributions that they could make to change.
And Keisha, are we seeing that with Black Lives Matter and the fact that we're seeing coalitions of people out marching in support of the reforms of policing?
I think so. And especially this year in particular, I think we've seen the significance of white allies. And I'm thinking about just various examples, including Portland and how white allies physically, you know, place their bodies on the line in order to support the work of the activists. And I would just quickly say, too, especially as elections are approaching, what can white allies do? They can vote in a careful manner, because I reflect on the fact that a significant number of white women voted for Trump. And here we are talking about Trump and some of his discourse and how it has inflamed a lot of this conversation, you know, and emboldened white supremacists. Well, guess what? Vote carefully. If you're truly an ally, even though there might be various reasons why you'd want to vote for Trump, maybe you should think twice.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Exactly. Daryl, I'll just do because there's so many questions I'm not going to get to. If you have questions, I am so sorry. Please continue the conversation on combat hate. And we'll definitely respond to you as we do this with Brookies. But I just want to wrap up from two just final comments from Daryl and John. Daryl, I'll go to you. Are you having Thanksgiving at home with your family this year? Because I know you write this piece on what to avoid at the dinner table. Will these conversations actually come up this year?
Yeah, that was one of my most widely read pieces, something I wrote right before Thanksgiving, like how to talk about politics, race, and other issues in divided families. Because it turns out there are a lot of divided families. And I like Fred's advice in terms of talking about it within your families. And what I have found is when people view this as an abstract issue, it's almost impossible to crack. If you personalize the issue and bring it down to individuals they know or situations that they confront, it's easier for people to think about these issues and to actually have reasonable conversations about them.
So John, I'll end with you. We're coming up against an election. This is still a big issue that is sitting on the table. Your opinion going forward, we can't be silent anymore, right?
No, we can't. And this issue about what do allies do? Allies have got to lead. And they've got to see that leadership comes in many different forms. First of all, you have to live your commitment. You got to live your commitment. You can't be ambiguous on this matter. And second, where you can, you have to lead from the front as attempting or in being an agent for change. You have got to live the reality and the commitment to change. And if you're not doing that, you might be a spectator. You might even be a cheerleader. But if we really want change, you've got to lead in that process. And that's what I would say to white allies. You've got to be prepared to live that change and to lead that change. And if you're not, you're just a spectator.
That's right. And what I would say to all the people that are watching who are from the African diaspora, Black Americans from all over the world, I would just say keep fighting and keep staying courageous, because as we fight white supremacy, as it was stated, it has to be called out. Your lived experiences matter. And that's why Black lives matter in many respects. If you don't agree with the movement, at the end of the day, all Black lives do matter. And that level of resistance still historically has been there because we're still here. And we still will be here. If not, and we're going to be here in more numbers. So just get ready. With that being said, I want to thank everybody for being in this conversation. I've been watching the Twitter. Yes, as my friend Joe Miller said, this is probably the conversation of the year. If you weren't here, you missed it. We will have this up on streaming for you to tell other people. Brookings continues to invest in these kind of conversations because we care. And as we go forward, we continue through all of our scholars here to have some semblance of how we get to a more systemically equal world. With that being the case, thank you everybody for joining us on the panel. I appreciate all of you giving me your 1 hour of time. To those of you that listen to us, I can't help but say this. I got a book coming out next year, as well as we've got a great podcast coming out of Tech Tank. So on the tech stuff, we're actually hitting many of the questions that you all brought up. So thank you again, and we will see you soon.